Okay, thanks. So it's very nice to be back here. And so this is what I'm going to talk about. This is mostly joint work with Vince Moncrief. And I guess I've talked about this material here before, essentially, but I would like to take another opportunity to make some propaganda for this elliptic hyperbolic formulation, since there are some numerical people in the audience here. And so just to fix the notation that I'm going to use, so I used bars for space-time quantities, and so we have a foliation, and the level sets are called M. There's a 3 plus 1 or n plus 1 split. The second fundamental form is called K. And some of the time I use an adapted frame. Okay, thanks. Built out of the time-like normal T and the space-like frame E sub I. Okay, some background and motivation. So the reason this elliptic hyperbolic formulation that I'm going to talk about was developed was to use it as a tool for proving a small data global existence result. And so the long-term goal is to understand the structural maximal globally hyperbolic vacuum space times. And of course, the very long-term goal is to understand issues like cosmic censorship, the asymptotic behavior near singularities, so issues related to the BKL conjecture, and also asymptotic behavior in the expanding direction. And another issue related to this is global uniqueness in the sense of the Chaudet-Briha-Giroch theorem. And so what may be quite important there is what regularity do you actually need to have this global uniqueness. And I will talk a bit more about that later.
Now, can I ask a simple question? So this year, your final goal, but why is it that you think it's better to go with elliptic hyperbolic system rather than just with purely hyperbolic?
Well, I mean, one reason is, there are two main reasons. I mean, so the one expects that if you have, or at least I expect, and I think there is some evidence for that in the literature, if you have a purely hyperbolic formulation, that means you have a hyperbolic equation that determines the coordinates, for example, you, in general, you expect to have coordinate singularities. And it's conceivable. It looks possible that you can avoid that by using an elliptic equation that determines the evolution of the coordinates. That's one reason. Another reason is that if you have a hyperbolic equation for the coordinates, they will the embedding parameters, the lapse and shift, will have essentially the same regularity as the space-time metric. Whereas if you have an elliptic system that determines the lapse and shift, you can gain one derivative over the space-time metric. And that may be important in this for the problem of global uniqueness, because there you need to do, you need to be able to patch together sort of regions of space-time coming from different sets of coordinates. And when you do that, you lose one derivative. However, if you have, if the lapse and shift are governed by an elliptic system, you have one extra derivative to play around with, so you can avoid this problem. So that's those are some of the reasons why it seems to me that an elliptic hyperbolic formulations of the evolution problem has some real advantages over a purely hyperbolic formulation, or over a formulation that where you set the gauge degrees of freedom, by specifying gauge source functions on the whole space-time a priori, for example, and get a hyperbolic formulation by rewriting, by adding variables to the Einstein equations to make it hyperbolic to the ADM system, for example. And so one concrete example of this reasoning that's another conjecture, is the CMC conjecture, which basically states that if you look at vacuum space times spatially compact, then any spatially compact vacuum space time which contains one constant mean curvature hypersurface should contain a foliation of such hypersurfaces where the mean curvature takes on all geometrically allowed values. And such a foliation will typically be global in the sense that it will cover the space-time all the way to the singularity, if you have a cosmological singularity. So if that conjecture is true, and there are as far as I know, no counterexamples, then that would indicate that the constant mean curvature gauge, which is you might think of as an elliptic gauge, is favored in the sense that it has good global properties. Okay, so those are some motivations. So I'll just quickly mention some results along these lines. So first of all, so what I'm going to talk about is this constant mean curvature spatially harmonic gauge, and that was developed in a paper by myself and Vince Moncrief, which has appeared in now Henri Poincaré. There's another paper which uses this setup to prove a sort of a small data global existence result for the Einstein equations. And so in that paper, we prove the existence of a large class of future complete 3 plus 1 vacuum space times. And this is sort of the ideas are quite similar to the work of Vince and Yvonne on future complete U1 space times, but there are certain technical difficulties in that work are not present here. Here the difficulty is that you're in 3 plus 1 with no symmetry, but the asymptotics in this situation is a lot simpler than in the U1 problem, because there are no Teichmuller degrees of freedom here. And also recently, this is still under preparation. So the original result for this CMC spatially harmonic gauge is that the evolution problem is well posed in this classical range of regularity. But you can actually push that using the Strickers inequalities to this regularity, H2 plus epsilon, in 3 plus 1 dimensions. And of course, the long-term goal is to get this down to H2, where you might get interesting things or interesting results out. It's not clear, actually, what this result will buy you, so to speak. it's more like, you know, one has to see how far this can be pushed. Okay. So as I said, well, I mean, this is my way of thinking, and there may be other points of view, but if you look at hyperbolic gauge conditions, if you use that for the Einstein equations, you will get a quasi-linear hyperbolic system, and for large data such systems. Will typically develop singularities in short time, and so you expect, even though you have reasons to expect that there is a point of view where the Einstein equations are well behaved globally, the gauge conditions that you choose may behave badly, and you may get sort of spurious singularities. So. You know, so that argument leads to thinking that for global results you would need an elliptic gauge like the constant mean curvature condition. And the point I'm trying to make is that may also be good from the point of view of numerics. And for global uniqueness, as I said, you need to do this kind of patching, and if you have only sort of HS regularity for the coordinates, you're going to lose one derivative when you do the patching. On the other hand, so that limits the class of initial data for which you can prove this global uniqueness. And with the current sort of best results, one would need H3 plus epsilon. And the long-term goal here is to push this to H2. And with an elliptic hyperbolic formulation, one can now push this to H2 plus epsilon, because you can avoid this loss of regularity when you do the patching. Okay, so I'm just going to go over some of the details of this version of the Einstein equations that we're looking at. So we have a space-time m bar. These are the curvature and connections, the curvature and connection. And I fix a background metric, which is a C infinity. And I mean, in the paper, this is supposed to be a C infinity negative curvature metric. But in fact, you can choose this appropriately for the problem at hand. And I will talk about that more later. But in the paper that we have that has appeared, this is assumed to be a C infinity negative curvature metric, but that's just a technical condition. Okay, so the Einstein equation is of course equivalent to this system of evolution and constraint equations. So that's what the ADM equations look like in this notation. And so now, to introduce the gauge condition that we're looking at, I introduce this vector field V, which is the contracted difference of the Christoffel symbols in the current metric, in the dynamical metric G, and this fixed background metric. And then this V is, with the usual conventions, this is minus the tension field of the identity map viewed as a map from M with the current metric E to M with the fixed background metric. So this is just a sort of more general version of the usual harmonic coordinate condition where you would have this gamma hat equal to zero. And the gauge condition that we're looking at is this gauge condition. So it's a constant mean curvature condition. So this only sort of makes sense in the case where you have spatially compact, where M is compact. But you can certainly think of other alternatives for this. And the other condition is that this tension field vanishes. And again, so those were the conditions that we looked at in the paper, but you can vary these in different ways. And I'm confident that this won't be a problem, but this certainly hasn't been worked out. So one alternative is to look at something like prescribed mean curvature. So I sort of take the normal derivative of the mean curvature and put that equal to a priori prescribed function on the space-time that can be possibly used to sort of to tune the evolution. And similarly, the normal Lie dragging of this tension field is set to be equal to some prescribed function. And if you choose this F alpha to be 1, 0, then you get just this gauge that we have studied in detail. But I'm confident that this won't introduce any real problems. And in fact, Yvonne Choquet-Briha and Jim York have looked at essentially this gauge, but in a different setting where they were using shift equal to zero and then extracting a wave equation for the second fundamental form.
Can your Fs be functions of the metric and the
intrusions? Preferably not. I mean, I have to say, I haven't studied this in detail at all. I think from sort of general considerations and other examples, it seems certain that you can do this. And I mean, this didn't cause any, having this function around as an a priori given function didn't cause any problems in this paper I mentioned by Choquet-Briha and York. And I doubt that this will cause any problems here. There's an old paper by Goganov and Kapitansky for the Yang-Mills system where they also look at essentially some prescribed gauge like this, or some inhomogeneous gauge like this. And also for the if you're doing the asymptotically flat case, there is no reason why one couldn't consider an elliptic hyperbolic formulation like this. So for example, you could choose trace k equal to zero, tension field equal to zero, and then impose the condition that the lapse goes to one and the shift goes to zero at infinity. So those would be those type of conditions would be compatible with the elliptic system that results from this gauge condition here. Okay, so there are some some technicalities involved in this, since we have the two connections or two covariant derivatives floating around, and we have on the one hand we have the dynamical metric G, and we have this fixed background metric G hat, And so the g hat has its own covariant derivative. But you can sort of, you can build those together and form this Laplacian, which involves the background connection and the metric and the volume element from the dynamical metric. So this operator is sort of the rough Laplacian on a tensor bundle over M, which has a covariant derivative defined out of this background covariant derivative and the metric G. Okay, and once you have introduced that, then you can notice that the Ricci tensor of the dynamical metric can be written in this form, where you have this if we take gamma hat to be the Euclidean metric, this would just be the scalar Laplacian acting on the components of G. Here we have an expression which is quadratic in the first derivatives of G, and this is a junk term, which is the symmetrized covariant derivative of this tension field.
So is this exactly the same trick that makes things hyperbolic for space-time harmonic coordinates, and now you're making them elliptic?
Yeah, this is exactly the same calculation here. And certainly you can go through the same calculation with a background space-time metric. So you can introduce a background space-time metric and introduce harmonic coordinates with respect to that if you got that idea. And the point as exactly as in the case with the space-time harmonic coordinates, in that case, if I subtract off this junk term, then I get a quasi-linear wave operator by leaving that out. Here I get a quasi-linear elliptic operator. And that's very important for what we're doing. So this is all well known in some sense, but in appearing in a different notation. So now if you take the ADM equations and time differentiate the gauge condition, you get, first of all, you get this, this is just the equation for the, what should be in the right-hand side here is the time derivative, or the the normal derivative of the mean curvature, which we had set to 1. So this is nothing, this is just the usual Laplace equation. Here, this is the equation that results from differentiating the equation V equal to zero along the Einstein flow. And this is not completely obvious, because this, if you do that sort of naively, the resulting equation will involve the covariant Laplacian from the dynamical metric and the Ricci tensor from the dynamical metric, and also a term involving the Lie dragging of the tension field V, and basically these junk terms coming from differentiating the metric, the GMN in the definition of the V. And this is just sort of direct, but here what turns out is that you can rewrite this combination of covariant Laplacian and Ricci in this form. And this involves the background curvature. So if the background metric is flat, for example, this would be 0. And if the background metric has negative sectional curvature, this operator here will have a sign. Because this is negative definite, that would be negative definite. So this would have a sign. And this is a gauge quantity multiplying a derivative of the shift. So this is, if we're in gauge, this will be zero. So this is what we call the defining equations for lapse and shift. And so this operator involves only first derivatives of the metric, of the dynamical metric G. So this has good properties as far as regularization. So we'll, from the system you see that you gain one derivative in the lapse and shift over the dynamical metric G. Here also the right hand side here also involves essentially one derivative of the dynamical metric. Okay. So that's a fairly important observation from our point of view. And now, since we're interested in solving a gauge fixed problem, we can subtract off any term from the Eisen equations that is zero in the gauge. And in particular, I can subtract off this term that I call del ij, which gives me this combination, which is a quasi-linear elliptic operator. So this system here will be hyperbolic. And so the fact is that the combination of this hyperbolic system and the elliptic defining equations is an elliptic hyperbolic system. So this can then be shown to be locally well posed in HS for S greater than n halves plus 1, and also, as I mentioned, at least in three dimensions, in H2 plus epsilon. So a half derivative better. Okay, so the evolution equations that one is actually solving is a priori not equivalent to the ADM equation or the Eisen equations. It is only when you impose the gauge conditions that you get a system that is equivalent to the Eisen equations. But you can happily evolve this off the constraint and gauge set. But there is a combination of the constraint and gauge quantities that evolves under a hyperbolic system. And for that system, you can do energy estimates which show that if the constraints and gauge conditions are satisfied initially, they remain satisfied under the evolution of this system. So to do that, we introduce the following quantities. So these are all gauge and constraint quantities in the sense that these quantities are zero if and only if the constraint is the constraints and gauges are satisfied. So A is measures the deviation of the mean curvature from being the prescribed mean curvature. This is the tension field. This is the Hamiltonian constraint. But it's convenient to subtract off this divergence of the tension field. And this is something that will be essentially zero if the momentum constraint is satisfying. So if we can show that as a consequence of this modified evolution system that these quantities are zero along a solution curve, if they're zero initially, then this will mean that this modified evolution system will preserve constraints and gauges and consequently that the constructed space-time will be actually be a solution of the Einstein vacuum equations. So a calculation shows that to leading order, if you calculate the normal derivative of these quantities, you get the following leading order terms. And so you see that there's something like a wave equation for the A and the F, so the momentum and constraint. So those are, you know, known since a long time to be dual to one another. And so that goes back essentially to York, I guess. And similarly, the tension field and this quantity D are in some sense dual to one another. And you can write this in a form involving where this elliptic operator is the same operator that showed up in the defining equations. So this is something like a wave equation satisfied by these constraints. And so as a consequence of that, you can then introduce an energy expression, calculate its time derivative on using this modified evolution equation and the defining equations and so on, and show that you have an energy inequality, something like this, so that the time derivative of the energy is dominated by some constant depending on the solution curve times the energy. And so by Gronwall, this means that if the energy is zero initially, it will remain zero along the solution curve. So this is quite insensitive in the sense that you can push this all the way to H2 plus epsilon in three dimensions. Okay, so so the theorem is roughly this. So what to summarize what I said, this constant mean curvature spatially harmonic Cauchy problem, which is given by the modified evolution equations and this system of defining equations, is locally well posed in H n half plus 1 plus epsilon. And furthermore, if the initial data satisfy the Einstein constraints and the gauge conditions, those will remain satisfied along the solution curve. And also, as I mentioned, this can be pushed to H2 plus epsilon. But this result only uses the sort of classical energy estimates. But to go further, you need to use the Stricker's inequalities, which those are inequalities of roughly this form. So you look at the solution of the free wave equation, for example, on a Ricci flat background, and you can then prove that a space-time LPL infinity norm of d phi is bounded in terms of essentially an HS norm of the initial data, but you can pick out power of the length of the time interval. So a positive power of the time of the length of the time interval you're looking at can be, you gain that much. So you gain a certain amount of smallness for this norm, and that's what allows you to push this local well postedness through. So this Stricker's estimate is probably less well known, and just to say a couple of words about why that that is true is, well, so if we're looking at the solution of the homogeneous wave equation in a space-time which is somewhat under control, then you expect to have the null cones in the space-time should have a certain amount of expansion, somewhat like the expansion you have in Minkowski space. And the solution to the wave equation will spread out in the characteristic directions. And by spreading out, it will also decay. And and it's this decay of waves that enables you to prove this LP L infinity estimate by doing a frequency decomposition of the free solution and looking at sort of each frequency separately. And of course, if you have a very rough space-time, for example, H2 plus epsilon or even H3, then you don't have very good control over the geometry of the null cones on large scale. So if you want to evolve for a time one, you don't have very good control over the light cones on that scale. But a wave of frequency lambda, you have good enough control on a scale depending on the frequency. So the higher frequency, the shorter time scale you have control. But that's enough to get this the necessary decay in this estimate. So this is the typical time scale that you have control over, where this epsilon zero is some small number depending on the gap that you have between H2, between 2 and the regularity that you're interested in. Okay. Okay, and so if you look at space-time, harmonic coordinates, that leads to a wave equation for the space-time metric, which is quadratic in the first derivatives. Now, if you look at spatially harmonic coordinates, you have an elliptic system. The Ricci tensor corresponds to an elliptic system, which is quasi-linear. But in fact, you can extract from this modified evolution equations a covariant wave equation for the spatial part of the metric. So in this setup, the lapse and shift are not dynamical fields; they are gauge fields, and they're just going along for the ride, determined by this elliptic system that I talked about. But the dynamical field is the spatial metric, and that does that is governed by a wave equation that can be extracted from this setup. So to write that down, it's convenient to think of, so here I'm introducing just a new notation to sort of keep things in perspective somewhat. So the field we're interested in is U, and its time derivative is roughly this V. And we think of these fields as sections of a tensor bundle over the manifold with covariant derivative defined by the condition that the first order derivative is given by this background connection. And then higher order derivatives will then involve also the connection coming from the dynamical metric G. So this is a covariant derivative compatible with the metric G. And we can extend this to a bundle over the space-time by just introducing another So this is now a bundle over the space-time, also with a covariant derivative defined by these conditions. So in the time-like direction, is we just sort of pretend that nothing is happening. So this is just a d by dt. Here, in the spatial directions, we use the covariant derivative I just introduced. And then for higher order derivatives, things follow from these two conditions. Now, so here's then the covariant wave operator defined out of this covariant derivative. And it turns out that you can actually write down a wave equation where this is the wave operator, and that wave equation will govern the spatial metric. And so to write that down, let me introduce some notation here. So this modified evolution system can be written in this form using the variables u and v. So it's, for this, to see what's going on, it's important to, well, at least the way I want to see it, is I split the lead derivative into a covariant derivative and a source term. This is the source term. Similarly, the equation for the second fundamental form becomes, well, the driving term is this Laplacian. You have a covariant derivative, and you have a source term. The source term involves the rest of the lead derivative and stuff coming from the curvature. This is an expression involving first order derivatives of metric second fundamental form and up to two derivatives of the lapse. But that's no problem because the lapse is governed by an elliptic equation. So this is not a problem. And now a calculation shows that this modified evolution equation can be written in this form. So a wave operator on u equals source. And the source is somewhat complicated, but not terribly so. And the reason I'm stressing this is that there seems to be some, at least according to some people's opinion, an advantage of having a wave equation rather than, let's say, a first-order symmetric hyperbolic system, since you can take advantage of the structure of the wave equation. Not all symmetric hyperbolic systems are wave equations, and having a wave equation allows you to use other types of methods for evolving that than having just a first-order symmetric hyperbolic system. I don't know that this will be significant, but this may be something to look at. Okay, so I think I'll basically finish by sort of giving you my list of things to do. The first and pretty obvious thing to do is to look at an asymptotically flat version of this setup. And for that, you may choose this background metric G hat to be, for example, Euclidean or Schwarzschild. And this has been looked at somewhat, I believe, by Vince in some examples. And so this can be expected to make sense. Another thing to do, as I mentioned, is to look at an inhomogeneous gauge version along the lines of prescribed mean curvature. And that should allow one to to sort of tune the evolution according to what you observe as you evolve. Another pretty obvious thing to do is to look at the conformally split version. So in this, there's an older paper by myself, Vince, and Tromba, where which basically used exactly this setup, except that in this 2 plus 1 situation, we also split off the conformal factor. And this is also an idea that is used in the work of Yvonne and Vince for the U1 problem. And it's an obvious thing to look at a situation where you split off a conformal factor, for example, by imposing a condition on the scalar curvature of the spatial metric. And this has been observed to be have good properties numerically in these various reformulations that have been done recently. And finally, and which I think really is something that one should look at, is look at, since we have a gauge fixed elliptic hyperbolic formulation, you can then also go to a completely gauge fixed and I expect to be well post initial boundary value formulation, where you have initial conditions, boundary conditions, both for the for parts of the dynamical fields and for the lapse and shift. So, for example, on an interior boundary, you could consider imposing Dirichlet boundary conditions for the lapse and shift to control what's going on there, and also at an exterior boundary, that is possible. So I think this is from you know general facts about the elliptic hyperbolic systems that certainly is expected to be feasible. The fact that we also have constraints for the Einstein equations makes this somewhat more complicated, but I think that's not really going to be a problem. So, and I think this. It's worth comparing this at least to other boundary value formulations of the Einstein equations. But of course, none of this work has actually been done. So I think I'll stop there a bit early. Thank you.
Is there any hope of doing it with some kind of outgoing wave boundary condition instead of Dirichlet boundary conditions?
Well, I mean that would be for the dynamical field then, I suppose, and that certainly should be possible. I think there, you know, whatever conditions that are well posed in general, there should be a version of that for this elliptic hyperbolic system. But some of what seems attractive to me is that you can actually, in principle, you can prescribe the behavior of the coordinate system on the boundary, and the elliptic equations will, you know, tell you how to define that in the interior of the domain. And I mean, that may or may not be a good thing, but it seems at least worth looking at. Yeah.
Of course, the case where you use it is perfect. The elliptic equations, they have this essentially harmonic map condition,
yeah,
you have. So it's fine with this negative curvature. But in the general case, want to get some problems to have global solutions for the elliptic system?
That's certainly a concern. I mean, that is a concern, and that hasn't been studied. I mean, an analogous case is the Ricci flow with the Turk trick, the worst that can happen is that you get some finite dimensional co-kernel, basically, for this elliptic system, and so usually there are ways around that, but. Vince and I have avoided this problem in the paper by simply imposing the condition that G hat has negative curvature. But I think, for example, if G hat is flat, which is the natural thing in the asymptotically flat case. Yeah, exactly. I believe Vince has looked at some examples in a sort of Schwarzschild background which didn't seem to cause any major problems. But of course that hasn't been studied in any detail. But I don't think that this will be really an issue. Generically, I think this will have good properties. Yeah.
We always told ourselves that we could do some kind of perturbation to avoid a kernel, even if it doesn't have a sign.
Yeah, that's my feeling. I mean, so essentially, if you wiggle this G hat a little bit, then generically that will destroy the kernel and co-kernel and make this make the problem well posed. So.
Do you think could he lose anything if he were to promote the elliptic equations to parabolic equations and try to evolve them? That's something that people tend to do to avoid solving elliptic equations.
Uh-huh. That I haven't looked at. I was under the impression that it's very expensive to solve parabolic equations numerically.
So sometimes
you get results for elliptic equations by passing to the limit with parabolic.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh. Yeah, no, this is not something, I wasn't aware of this, and I haven't...
I said that earlier, like that, but that's an old idea, to deal with the constraints in the lapse and shifts, you know, replacing the elliptic equations by parabolic equations.
Well, some people have used some people like Mark and me have worked on the first interval dot equation, which is
on... We revert to a hyperbolic, and not parabolic.
Yeah. The question really is whether your worries about singularities in the solutions apply to a hyperbolic equation that's got enough damping in it that it's just slightly beyond the parabolic, just far enough beyond parabolic to allow the numerical integrations to be cheaper.
Uh-huh. You're talking about as an alternative to solving the elliptic system.
That's right, because if you take the simplest elliptic equation and try to solve it numerically by these relaxation methods, it turns out you're solving the heat equation.
Oh, really? Uh-huh.
And if you don't like the convergence rate of the heat equation, you do what they call over relaxation, which turns out to mean that you're solving the wave equation with a significant damping term.
Huh.
And of course, with enough damping, the wave equation comes down to the solution to the elliptic equation. Now, the question is, when you put that much damping into a hyperbolic equation, do you still have these worries that you considered about evolving into singularities?
Oh, that's very interesting. Yes.
Unless you drop the terms that sort of disturb the ellipticity of the Ricci tensor, which is really only justified if you really make them zero, you know, then you lose the hyperbolicity of the metric equation. But I kind of thought that maybe for numerical purposes, as opposed to proof of theorems, it might be enough to just go ahead and drop them and impose this heavily damped wave equation for the lapse and shift, and then you're not really solving Einstein's equations unless this damping is sort of 100% efficient, but it might be good enough in
Yeah, that's worth looking at. And also another aspect of this is, as Rins has been telling me recently, that there are methods which make elliptic problems linear in complexity. And that's an argument in favor of being able to solve them actually directly at every few time steps, so to speak. And it shouldn't be necessary to solve these systems at every time step, because we know that the modified evolution equation does preserve gauge and constraints. So.
You're referring to Michael Holst's
yes.
constraint solver. I mean, that even deals with the Hamiltonian momentum constraint, which our elliptic system here does not try to use
right.
as an elliptic system. So in principle, he's even kind of geared up for doing a fully constrained
yeah.
evolution, where everything that can be solved in elliptic equations is done at linear.
Yeah, so one can certainly go further, and when I mentioned this conformally split, I was actually thinking of this the idea of splitting not only the conformal factor from the spatial metric, but also the fact that you can split off. A conformal killing tensor from the second fundamental form and reduce yourself to dealing with only with sort of dynamical degrees of freedom in some sense. This is, I guess, what you're referring to.
Yeah, one thing that occurred to me is a possible fly in the ointment of trying to do this kind of fully constrained setup where you work on a work with a space of metrics that live in some slice of the conformal metrics that live in some slice. And that is that the one problem that doesn't fit into this kind of simple elliptic picture is the harmonic map equation itself. In other words, if you had to actually solve a harmonic map elliptic equation, put yourself on the slice at each time step, and then do the diffeomorphism, that's really an unpleasant problem.
Uh-huh.
And I think we avoided it at all costs.
Yeah, yeah.
That's one thing that might interfere with doing a sort of totally 2 degrees of freedom constrained evolution.
Okay,
right.
That's a good point.
I'd like to use David's advocate saying that it seems that there is new work going on in your world, you can be sure, trying to prove that harmonic coordinates, I mean space time harmonic coordinates, are in fact good coordinates. Since Rodniansky and Lindblad, and maybe are collaborative also on that, are thinking they can prove global existence in this.
Well, that's for small data, yes, yes. So, the story behind that is that, of course, the original work of Christodoulou and Kleinemann was using maximal slicing, which is an elliptic gauge
yes,
in this
yes,
sense.
Yes, yes.
And what
we are using just high-value equation.
That's correct. Yes, and in fact that is interesting, but I'm not sure if whether it is actually relevant to the strong field case, and it's certainly interesting. And
but I think American people they've never tried really to solve. Second order equation,
they have nice properties that seem to be better. Okay. Yeah, because this is something that was stressed to me by Kreis, I believe, he was suggesting that one should really look at wave equations in favor as opposed to just first order symmetric hyperbolic systems. And of course, I don't personally have any experience with either numerically. So, yes.
When you look at the behavior of constraints, you get these sort of nice bounds that show that the constraints sort of blow up no faster than exponential.
Mm-hmm.
So, from the mathematical point of view, this is but from the numerical point of view, a constraint that blows up exponentially is not very pleasant either.
Absolutely.
Is there any way to do better, or any way to, you know, at least show that the exponential blow up, you know, I mean, that one can sort of beat down this constant to something manageable?
Well, I mean, there's been lots and lots of work recently on these sort of parametrized families of evolution systems for the action equations, and a person with infinite amounts of time would be able to do the same thing for this formulation.
But you cannot have fully contained. There's going to be some evolution equations, so even if you can pin down the elliptic segment. Right.
Well, but I mean, the point is that by adding you know, factors, multiples of the constraints, or you know, by adding in multiples of the constraint and gauge quantities in the evolution equations, you can modify the evolution equation for this energy expression that I wrote down for the gauges and constraints, and presumably change or, you know, modify the stability properties of that, and you know, improve those stability properties in the same, in a way similar to what has been achieved using these first order symmetric hyperbolic formulations with the parametrized families of where you have these parametrized families of systems.
Right, so, but at the end of the day, you still have an exponential, and the factor would be smaller, but
yeah, but I guess in those systems you do as well.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a pragmatic problem. I mean, you do as well as you can in some sense. Yeah.
Do you have a formulation of Maxwell theory that'd be a good model for what you're doing here?
Well, I mean, the model there would be the Coulomb gauge or something like that, Of course, in that situation, will be globally well behaved. There is also the Coulomb gauge for the Yang-Mills system. Yeah, and I mean that's the gauge that was used in the Kleinemann-Makedon work. So in that, from that point of view, and certainly in that case for the lower, for the initial problem with lower regularity data, the Coulomb gauge seems to be favored. And there's a formulation which allows by using a background connection somewhat similar to this G hat. There's a formulation I think due to Vince that allows you to have a globally prescribed Coulomb gauge for the Yang-Mills.
In case with a time-like boundary, can the Coulomb gauge be used with semaphore conditions on the free fields?
That's a question I'm not able to answer. That's that relates to these kind of issues that we haven't looked at.
It's probably worth mentioning also that when you talk about Yang-Mills, that this Coulomb gauge works, but Lorentz gauge does not always work.
Yeah.
Gauge groups for which the Lorentz gauge solutions can blow up in a frame.
Mm-hmm.
It comes back to the way maps in four dimensions can blow up.
Right. So there are lots of interesting analogies between these situations. And Yvonne mentioned the fact that now. I mean, it's not done, but Lindblad and Rodniansky believe they can do sort of small data global existence for the action equations in wave coordinates. And that's sort of analogous to the Lorentz gauge. And it is known that in the Lorentz gauge, you don't have the optimal decay behavior in the light-like directions for the Yang-Mills field, and that's precisely the problem also with the wave coordinates, that you don't get the optimal decay rate in the light-like direction. So that's why they have to split the Einstein equations into a system to be able to show this global existence in the wave coordinates. Yeah.
I know Feynman and Rodzinski have this big program to push the Einstein theory down to H2, I guess, in some formulation like the space-time harmonic. But do you have any feeling that this hyperbolic elliptic thing would work? I mean, you know, H2, if they can succeed with their program, or is that, that's a pretty big question.
Well, actually, my understanding from various conversations and so on is that there it's not clear to me or clear to them, I believe, that one whether one should expect to have well postedness in the wave coordinates in H2. It may very well be that there is a weak null condition that's satisfied by the Einstein equations in wave coordinates, which is it's a kind of you can extract a form where you have a system, you split the metric into two components, one which is governed by a good system, and that comes in as a source for the other system. So the good system has global existence, comes in as a source for the other system, and then you can. That's the idea how you get global existence, by having sort of good enough decay for the good system. But that type of null condition is known to, in general, to fail to be well posed in H2. So it may very well be that the Einstein equations are ill posed in H2 in wave coordinates, but well posed in some other gauge.
Talking about the decay rate at
non infinity. Yeah, in the light-like direction.
Make that very strong by adding a mass term to the wave equation.
Yes, but I guess, are you allowed to do that?
Yeah, that's fine. That doesn't change the principal part of the system.
Oh, you mean just in general? Yes, yes, sure. But here, I mean, if you're dealing with a specific system that you get that is the Einstein equation.
So the gauge, instead of the harmonic coordinates without a mass term, you can have a mass term to those to make the coordinates.
Yeah, okay, I see. But I don't have any feeling for how that affects the whole setup. That's
those are the bad coordinates at non-infinity.
Yeah.
That's
possible, yeah. Because they would have to have some strange asymptotic behavior because of that mass term. Yeah.
They wouldn't be very good at.
Yeah, exactly, and that's where all the problems are, really. Well, I mean, there are two types of problems. There are problems at null infinity, and there are problems at time-like infinity, and they're both bad. And this recent work using wave coordinates. Originally, I think the intention was to deal with the time-like infinity problem, but now it seems like they will be able to push that to really get a true small data global existence result.
Any other questions? Let's thank Klaus again.